that does it for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Kevin Pina and Miguel Gavilan Molina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Portland, Oregon Old Time Music Gathering from January 16th through the 20th at various locations around Portland. The Portland, Oregon Old Time Music Gathering aims to celebrate and enrich the community of traditional old time Appalachian style string band musicians. There will be jam sessions, a Cajun honky tonk night, concerts, dances, workshops, and performances. Again, that's the Portland, Oregon Old Time Music Gathering from January 16th through the 20th at various locations around Portland. Location and age restrictions vary. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is poet, editor, and translator Jeffrey Yang. Yang is the author of the poetry collections Vanishing Line and the Penn Joyce Osterweil Award-winning An Aquarium, both out with Grey Wolf Press. He is editor of the anthologies Birds, Beasts, and Seas, Nature Poems, and Time of Grief, Mourning Poems, and the collection The Sea is a Continual Miracle, Sea Poems and Other Writings by Walt Whitman. Yang is the translator of Imatjan Osman's Uyghur Land, The Farthest Exile, the Nobel Peace Prize winning Liu Xiaobo's June 4th Elegies, the 11th century Song Dynasty poet Su Shi's East Slope, and poet Bei Dao's autobiography City Gate Open Up. Jeffrey Yang works as an editor at New Directions Publishing and New York Review of Books, and he's here today to talk about his latest book of poetry, Hey, Marfa, from Grey Wolf, a book of image verse, his poems and conversation with paintings and drawings by the British artist Rackstraw Downs. Susan Howe calls Hey, Marfa a commonplace book, memoir, and hybrid obituary for things. Following a trail of last words and communal losses, here is a history learning to listen with eyes and mourning, recovering the dead travelers on the road. Hey, Marfa transmits voltage or vitalized matter as words reach to words. Tim Johnson of the Marfa Book Company says, Yang rebuilds for the reader a town that is notable for its many stark contrasts, restored and ruined buildings, wealth and poverty, international art and border enforcement. Hey, Marfa makes a remarkable poetic accounting of the ways imagination is currently working with and against the histories and myths of the U.S.-Mexico borderlands and the American West. The Poetry Society of America calls Hey, Marfa a truly unique project of text and visuals, a synthesis of lyric and history and landscapes. And finally, Booklist says, Yang has constructed an Escher-like collage by weaving together musings on Southwest America's past and accounts of current art movements, illustrated with the sublime paintings and drawings of British artist Rackstraw Downs. Hey, Marfa is itself an art object as much as a book of exacting poetry, a collection to read in wonder and then reread, discovering something new. Welcome to Between the Covers, Jeffrey Yang.
Thank you so much, David. It's great to be here.
So before we talk about the ways you engage with and interrogate and unpack place, specifically Marfa and Hey, Marfa, I wonder if we could start with describing the more general reputation Marfa, Texas has in the imagination. Like if you were to imagine being a member of the Chamber of Commerce or an artist who is returning from an artist residency who maybe didn't think deeply about what underpins Marfa. What is Marfa for someone who hasn't heard of Marfa?
So I think it's a place that's pretty remote, first of all, and I think that's part of how it's able to kind of continue the way it is. It's a place where a lot of creative people, artists and writers and, you know, clothes makers and all kinds of people have found a space to kind of do their work. It's also a place where it's very close, of course, to the border, to Presidio on our side and Ojinaga on the Mexico side. And so a lot of people who work also in the town come up from there. And so it's really a mix of Mexican-Americans and U.S. citizens and people who are out there. And I think most of the people who I've, you know, I've gotten to know there well, you know, like Tim at the Marfa Book Company, have found a place there to do what they want to do. And also it's a place where people come and visit, even though it is remote. And so that kind of helps the town too as well. So there's also the Chinati Foundation out there that Donald Judd kind of started.
Tell us a little bit about Donald Judd, since in a way he sort of puts the town on the map as a destination for artists, or at least that's my understanding. So who is Donald Judd and what did he do with Marfa that has made it a place where someone who may be from some entirely different demographic, different part of the country geographically would come there and have a residency or go look at internationally renowned art?
Yeah, no. So Donald Judd is a contemporary American artist associated with minimalism. And he went out there, and I want to, now I'm getting all the dates wrong, but I think it's sometime in the 70s. Is that about right?
I think so.
That's what it's in the book. But and he just kind of started to make art out there and buy property. And at the time, there wasn't much else in the town. And as he started to do more of his art out there, and it's an art that's very specific, you know, to the landscape of Marfa, which, you know, is a desert landscape, which I should have said in the beginning. And then it's also there's a little bit of elevation as you go down south, you go down a little bit. And so once he was there, and then other artists kind of came, and then this foundation, the Dia Foundation, started to support some of his work, and then eventually the Chinati Foundation took over that role and included a lot of other artists in their collection. And so the foundation there, there's two things. There's the Chinati Foundation that has a lot of this kind of very place-specific landscape art with people like Judd and there's some Carl Andre and a lot of different things. And then in the town itself, there's also these buildings that were Judd's kind of residence, his studios, and there's a space for John Chamberlain's art. And so there in that those spaces, you could also go as a visitor.
And when you were going there for an artist residency yourself, mm-hmm. were you going there with the intention of looking at Marfa, or did the book Hey Marfa as a project arise once you were there doing some other project?
Yeah, no, that's the thing. I never expected to write anything really about Marfa. I went out there. I was invited there on a one-month residency to work on a translation by Liu Xiaobo, his June 4th elegies. And I was very strict with my time to doing that, because I really needed to get a draft done of the book. And so it was only while I was there that I started to kind of experience being there for a time, and also meeting people and seeing a little bit more of the environment around there that I started, you know, I wrote some things while I was there, more notes and maybe a couple starts to poems and observations and things. And it was really when I left that over the years, it kind of just kept staying with me, and what I thought would maybe be a poem or a little, or a serial poem, kind of just kept kind of staying with me and wanting to be something else.
Yeah.
And so over time, you know, up through 2017, I was still kind of writing and thinking about these things. And in the book, it spirals out a lot in ways from the actual, if you're talking about the physical place, but it's connected, I think, in a way. So, yeah.
Well, I don't know if I've encountered a book that has a more perfect epigraph. I feel like the few words on the first page, they mm-hmm. echo through the whole book, and maybe as a sort of ethos uh-huh. for how you engage with Marfa. So first we get a quote from the old master from the spring and autumn period, both in Chinese and English. And I'm guessing that's Confucius?
Oh, it's Lao Tzu.
It's Lao Tzu.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, from the Tao Te Ching.
Okay. Yeah. So that quote is, truthful words are not beautiful. Beautiful words are not truthful. And then we get a separate, unrelated and unattributed line that says, these lines curve through the desert. And I do feel like these lines of the epigraph curve through the desert of this book, mm-hmm. beginning to end. But when we get on to the next page, we realize that you're also talking about a different sort of line, because we get one of Downs's paintings mm-hmm. of a electrical substation.
Right.
With the electrical lines coming off of the substation.
Right.
And so these lines of truthful words are not beautiful, beautiful words are not truthful, are going through the desert, but we're also seeing something that's ugly, potentially, mm-hmm. a substation that a lot of people might erase from their memory of a vacation.
Right.
Maybe being something truthful about how humans could potentially live and what relationship do they live to nature when they're out in the desert.
Right.
But after the painting, we get a one-line page that says, hey, beautiful Marfa, mm-hmm. suggesting that maybe there's something about the beautiful Marfa that isn't truthful. I feel like we could take that little gesture and that enactment you do in like mm-hmm. three or four pages of uh-huh. image and and very few words.
Yeah.
I feel like in a way could be seen as an ethos for the whole book. The New York Times art critic, Ken Johnson, he described Downs as painting beautiful pictures of ugly places. And it sort of feels like you're doing something similar, pointing out the things that are sort of willfully or casually not seen or erased or edited out in order to, say, experience Marfa only as the wondrous and weird art mecca in the desert. And it seems important to me that you start not in Marfa, but with your arrival in mm-hmm. the El Paso airport.
Right.
Because the curving line through the desert isn't just the poetic line and the electric lines, it's also the border.
Right.
Another exactly. curving line yeah. through the desert, and perhaps the ugliest, and then also then by, if we're going by the epigraph of Lao mm-hmm. Tzu, the most truthful line.
Right.
So tell us why we start in El Paso for you, and what that means as a first gesture for exploring Marfa, to start at the El Paso airport.
Yeah, no, I think that's an important part of the start of the book too, and it wasn't always there for the book, but it also kind of signified my original arrival and people's arrival to most people's arrival to Marfa is through El Paso, unless they take the train or drive, and being in El Paso and just seeing, I'd never been to El Paso, and just seeing the city, and you're driving through and you're really right along the border there. And, you know, I've read about this a lot, and Juarez across the way there, but to see it is something else. And so it's, you know, I grew up in San Diego, so I know, you know, some about the border there and La Jolla and Tijuana. But it was just an important place, I think, for the book to start too, and it fit because also of, you know, arriving there and then the time it takes, you know, it's like a 3.5 hour drive to Marfa through the desert first, you know, along the border. And so it's it seemed like a good place for the narrative of this book to start too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like you...
And all the issues, you know?
Yeah,
I mean, all the issues of the border and the U.S. And, yeah, so...
And the juxtaposition. Yeah, yeah. You're picked up in a Prius.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're contending with the border violence, border surveillance, the killing of women in Juarez, and sort of expanding and dilating a moment that I think a lot of people in transit to the artist residency wouldn't necessarily stay in their minds. And when we have that and the painting of the substations and your poems on Ciudad Juarez, it feels like in a handful of pages, you've not just situated us in place, but you've also raised questions of racism and misogyny and climate and nature and poverty and wealth. You have this line in that section, "I don't know which to hate more, violence or the causes of violence, my hate or the hate of others." And I wondered if you could maybe speak to this line in relationship to your meditation on Ciudad Juarez and El Paso and at Marfa.
It's such a dark part of our history, both sides of the border. But those lines specifically, I mean, it's, you know, it's obviously an allusion for those who read Wallace Stevens to 13 Ways of a Blackbird, Ways of Looking at a Blackbird. And he has a line, something like about, I don't know which, or about the whistle of the blackbird. I'm forgetting exactly. But so those lines, I mean, Juarez has been so kind of this, the worst of almost everything of our history and of contemporary history, Mexico's history, you know, these murders of women that really no one knows what's going on, but obviously it's connected to the drugs and to the the cartels, and also just the way power works and in our country and the factories along the border there, the foreign factories in Mexico, maquiladoras and things. And so I've read a lot about that history, and I mean, it's also something that you don't want to, you know, Juarez as a city has been trying to become a city, you know, and so you don't want that to just be the kind of focus and the overpowering memory of this place, and it's not, I think. And so it was interesting because while I was writing this from the start to beginning, things were changing in Juarez as well, you know, from what I read and from hearing from people. It had gotten a lot better, you know, and there was a lot more going on, but unfortunately now it's actually turning again, you know, the past couple of years. And so these cycles seem to come and go there. But those lines, I mean, it's really just about, you know, an individual perception and responsibility, also that feeling of little bit of help, you know, actually a lot of helplessness also in the face of all this violence. And then just what can we do really with hate, you know, because, and that idea of what, you know, the hate that kind of seems to perpetuate these things and anger and violence. But so it was kind of trying to deal with that in a way, and the different sides of that. Yeah.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to Jeffrey Yang about his latest poetry collection, Hey Marfa, from Grey Wolf Press. In your last collection, Vanishing Line, you also explore lines, timelines, bloodlines, and these join the borderline and the high voltage lines of this latest one. Throughout this book and the last book, you collage and interweave other voices into your poems. Mm-hmm. We might get quotes from a settler from the 19th century, or from a newspaper article, or from one of Donald Judd's cooks. And I was curious if there was an ethos or a desired aesthetic or political effect you were going for by enacting this, by placing your voice among many voices, by perhaps interrupting the cohesion of a lyric eye. I wondered about your thoughts on on changing the syntax by having other voices, by interbraiding, essentially like a community, not in just in space, but across time.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, I love having these voices in poems and poetry. And I mean, early on, I knew that these kinds of voices would be a part of the book, just as because it's the fabric of the place and the history there and of our country. And so I try and incorporate it, those quotes and those other people in ways that are respectful, you know, and also are part of the themes and interweavings of the poems, because I really think of it as a weaving in and out of different histories and languages and you know, more maybe travel kind of observations and nature kind of writing. And so these things all become a part of what the book is, and in a way of also trying to capture a bit of the spirit of the place. And so, yeah.
That's, yeah. Well, another set of voices that we encounter regularly in the book are quotes from something you call the Book of Last Words,
right? Yeah.
Which we soon figure out are literally the last words spoken by someone before they die.
Right.
Either the last words of an artist or the last words of an inmate executed by the state of Texas. Mm-hmm. So here again, maybe the twinning of ugliness and beauty. But I was wondering if you could tell us how these ended up in the book, and to what end we keep being reminded of the last words.
Yeah, no, that became part of the book pretty early on. I've been struck by last words, you know, for a while, and also just this idea of what last means. But you're right, these are all very real last words. And so I was surprised when I was, because I had written some of these things down before. But then I actually discovered there's these anthologies of last words, and lots of them are from, you know, the 19th century, if I'm remembering correctly, you know, where it was more popular to record these things, whether it was a loved one or famous people or something when it was possible. And somehow it just became a part of kind of the history and mythology of a person's life, you know. And so it's not just most of the time in these anthologies they're well known people in some way, you know, political figures or writers and things like that. But then a lot of these last words I kind of also found on my own, and also there's last words that are included people who were executed in Texas, and that I found kind of by chance, because these words are all online. I mean, they're all kind of there as a kind of document. It's a really horrifying thing to read and go through, but there's hundreds of them, and so I thought it was very important to include that as well as part of the book.
I made up my own narrative, thinking that you were working on the June 4th elegies,
right?
Liu Xiaobo,
right.
Elegies,
yeah.
Death haunted,
yeah.
He's in jail,
yeah.
Nobel Peace Prize winning,
yeah.
Writer, no longer with us. But
right.
I wondered if that played any role in informing that choice.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, I had never met Liu Xiaobo. He was already in prison, and there was always the big chance that he was never going to get out of prison, because his health was never particularly good. You know, it definitely worsened. And then it happened. He died still in prison, basically. And so that, and also people who I'd met in Marfa who later passed away. You know, there's a historian who I met there, she was at that point blind, and she had written this 2-volume history of Marfa. And she passed away, and there was a woman named Taigi, a rancher who I'd met, and then other people. There was the poet Robert Greeley, who had gone to Marfa and got sick there and then passed away. And so there was a lot of this this death that was there already. And so the Book of Last Words, I mean, they're also, these last words that are recorded become a kind of odd summation of a person's life, in for better or worse, but they have this heightened magnetic quality that I find also can be connected to just poem or poetry, the poetic line in ways. And so it also made sense to incorporate that. And so I just kind of imagined this Book of Last Words that these lines would be a part of. Yeah.
Well, one thing I noticed about the language of the settler colonists of Marfa, as well as sometimes in the last words of a dying person, mm-hmm. is a tendency towards the abstract and nonspecific. For instance, you quote Elsie Bright, mm-hmm. a cattleman and churchman from 1885, who says, "Before me was a new and untried country, an experiment." And Elsie Bright's phrase made me wonder if that sort of language that doesn't have to contend with other voices, mm-hmm. that is unimpeded and sort of cast over everything without a counterpoint, mm-hmm. is a vehicle for violence or a potential vehicle for violence. I think of a quote from mm-hmm. the Martinique poet Edouard Glissant, mm-hmm. who says, "I say that relation is made up of all the differences in the world, and that we shouldn't forget a single one of them, even the smallest. If you forget the tiniest difference in the world, well, relation is no longer relation. Now, what do we do when we believe this? We call into question, in a formal manner, the idea of the universal. The universal is a sublimation, an abstraction that enables us to forget small differences. We drift upon the universal and forget these small differences. And relation is wonderful because it doesn't allow you to do that." And I wondered your thoughts about this sentiment of his, and whether this at all underlies your choice to, contrary to, say, the settler mm-hmm. language, often you're specifying and cataloging, it feels like, in your books, whether it's an aquarium or the events that happen in the encounters with indigenous populations in Vanishing Line. Mm-hmm. It feels like you're doing something that is both polyvocal and mm-hmm. specifying around things that are erased.
Yeah. No, I mean, I love that quote. I could have used that in the book too. But no, I think like the Bright quote that you mentioned, it's true. There is something so general but also beautiful about that. But then by bringing it into the book, I was hoping to kind of, you know, counterpoint with these other voices. But I mean, I think a lot of what I love about poetry is in the particulars, in the very small particulars of whether it's the subject matter or in the smallest words. You know, George Aupin was always talking about the smallest words are the hardest ones to get right in a poem, and so that's a very important part for me when I'm writing, and trying to kind of move between those things. But it's also, I mean, those words of a settler, it's also, you see a lot of travel writing, and the history of travel writing as a kind of, can be a very kind of colonistic kind of colonizing gesture in generalizations. I mean, obviously the best travel writing is not like that, but and so trying to also question that and subvert that, you know, as a kind of record of being in a new place. You know, I've always been a fan, I mean, since college, of Jamaica Kincaid's A Small Place, which is about, you know, this tourist you going down to, I think it was Jamaica, if I'm remembering right. But and just challenging, you know, all of our assumptions, and not being blind to what is there, and being a more aware and conscious of your surroundings as a visitor to a place. And so I was trying to do that as well as much as I could with this book. Yeah.
Well, maybe this is a good time to hear a little bit of the poetry.
Sure.
Yeah. I've picked out two, page 24 and page 35.
Okay. Conquistadors. Sunrise over a dirt road, by a low wire fence, bird song. A rooster crows, then distant church bells, pealing arpeggios in the thin air. Two horses graze next to a roofless ruin. Light slowly swells, expands, fills the heavens, awakens the undergrowth, and the blood of the defeated running fast through the earth. Called minorities by conquest, swept along, on and beyond the state's three reservations, land once a republic of raids and counter-raids, of alliances kept and broken, of patara bueyes humanos sumas cados, of arbados, cutalchuches, higarias, lipans, of chibolos, kikapus, susolas, quitoles, malacones, of neches, coayas, coyoteros, atayos, apaches, comanches, atacapans, of piros, mescaleros, wichitas, tauvayas, toncawas, bidais, teas, cheyens, kiowas, carancawas, yutas, and on, diverse nations known through paged, named each stretch of sand, unspoken presence. Hope I got some of those pronunciations okay. That was the first time I read that. Although I always read it aloud.
Yeah, it's a difficult. I chose a difficult.
No, it's great. I'm glad. I like it. And this is called Substation. And actually, this is the first Substation poem I wrote for the book. But I think it's the second one that appears in the book. Substation. Live lines lead to the substation grid, vital node between the tracks and a lonely row of small houses, where an asphalt road meets lattice towers, high-tension buses and switches. Transmission lines sail to lightning gyres, lugs fix cross strut to strut transformers induct, step up, step down, fenced off structure, wooden pylons, against sand and sky, insulators, isolators, arresters, exed constructed monument to the unknown prisoner, receding cube within cube of walls of air, pantographic galvanized gantry, breaker and fuse, relay equipage, kilovolts hum unending ohm of the lamp's transmission, down at the switchyard, through the body, electromagnetic, lines bond totemic, linked, desert succulents, less wilderness, less relentless wasteland, lines, further prospect, toward a pure array of sun.
I've been listening to Jeffrey Yang read from Hey Marfa from Grey Wolf Press. I forgot that this poem has a nod to Whitman with the line through the body, electromagnetic.
Right. Yeah.
But I do want to ask you about Walt Whitman.
Okay. Yeah.
Because recently I had Tommy Pico on. He's from the Kumeyaay Nation near San Diego.
Yeah.
And his work explicitly declares a distrust of the first person plural use of we an ambivalence to abstract language.
Yeah.
So I was asking him questions, particularly as an indigenous poet, about his feelings about Walt Whitman.
Mm-hmm.
Since Whitman is explicitly trying to embody the American experiment, and because he employs a seemingly universal I and we in the service of a sort of poetic nation building, and because Whitman has a spotty, troublesome, and contradictory set of views toward indigenous people, toward African Americans, toward Mexicans, and others that he didn't see quite fitting into the American experiment as he saw it. And all of Tommy Pico's books are book length. Uh-huh. And so at one point I asked him what books influenced him, and he said Vanishing Line is one of the books that was influential. And I hadn't read it yet at the time. Uh-huh. This was a couple months ago.
Right.
And so I didn't know that your book, Vanishing Line, engages with the genocide of Native nations and also quotes Walt Whitman directly. So that was an interesting segue and coincidence. And I wanted to just read a short passage that you quote in Vanishing Line and then ask you some questions.
Sure.
So this is what you say in Vanishing Line. Whitman, who in March 1846 calls the slave trade a monstrous business, a disgrace and a blot on the character of the Republic, 1 year later writes, "With the present slave states, of course, no human being anywhere out from themselves has the least shadow of a right to interfere." 10 years later, he shifts emphasis and says, speaking about Africa, "In their own country, degraded, cruel, almost bestial, the victims of cruel chiefs and of bloody religious rites, lives never secure, no education, no refinement, no elevation, no political knowledge. Such is the general condition of the African tribes. It is also to be remembered that no race ever can remain slaves if they have it in them to become free. Why do the slave ships go to Africa only?" So I was wondering if you could speak to why we find these lines in Vanishing Line, and how, as an American poet yourself and a poet of color, how you orient yourself to Whitman and sort of his embodiment of the national project. Because then I think about, like, when we were talking about L.C. Bright,
right,
and I said, is there violence in this abstraction? And you said, yes, maybe, but it's also really beautiful. And clearly Whitman is very beautiful.
Yeah.
And then we go back to the epigram that that you have at the beginning of the book, that truthful things aren't beautiful.
Yeah.
I'm curious. So tell us about Whitman here in Vanishing Line, and then maybe you can you can broaden that to some of the stuff you're exploring in the Marfa exploration.
Right. Yeah. No, that's a good question. I mean, well, just first, I mean, Whitman. I should also say too, because you mentioned in the intro, I also edited this book of Whitman's writings focused on the sea, the poetry and the prose. I mean, Whitman, I have such an admiration for that first edition of Leaves of Grass, which came out in 1855, and these long lines and all these weird ellipses and dots and no titles and these long lines and what it was trying to do at that time. I mean, but it also, it's true. I mean, Whitman is a very contradictory and controversial figure, in the sense that he also was, you know, his own best publicist in ways, and so I think in Vanishing Line, in that particular, where those lines come up, it was in a long poem called Yenicott in that book, and that book dealt with a lot of the history in the northern tip of Long Island. And so Whitman there, it was important to kind of, for me, to bring in there, like, one, because, you know, Whitman loved Long Island and he walked along the beaches there. And also then, also as the figure of our most probably revered poet in the U.S., you know, but then also seeing, like, some of the letters in his, I think it's his journals, I can't remember, for it's all in this, these complete works, you could see the prose, a lot of this other prose that isn't as well read, at least previously, and you could see some of these things that he's thinking about race, but then it's so interesting because he keeps it out of the poetry. You know, he keeps that out of the poetry. It's almost like he's editing himself in a way. But then in these articles, which sometimes aren't even he attributed to him, but like as an editorial kind of a thing for the paper he happened to be working at the time, or in that sense. So, But it was kind of shocking to read those things, actually, because I had heard about them. I'd actually first read pieces about that, and then to actually go and find it and read it, it's pretty shocking, and it's never taught like that. Whitman is not a complicated figure when you learn about him. When I learned about him in high school, and so for me it was one way in that poem where I was dealing with kind of the history and mythology of that area, of that kind of imagined place. That he was a part of that landscape. And so in here too, you know, when you're talking about the opening of the West and you're thinking about the desert and just that and a lot of that history, you know, there's some of the kind of old railroad history that comes in too, you know, which connects to the technology of the wires, you know. It's a similar kind of thing, this idea of what America was supposed to be, you know, and what it really was. And there's such a contrast between that ideal and the real of what was really going on. And Whitman, of course, was always talking about the ideal and the real in poetry and in prose. And so it's those kinds of themes, you know, they're all throughout our history here, and so he became part of the text too, in a way.
You have that line in Hey Marfa, we extend his leaves with acts of conquest.
Right, exactly. And so that was spoken through a character in the book, a named Straw, and so. Yeah, I mean, I'm more of the reader who will, you know, still read Whitman and still appreciate so much about his work, but it doesn't have to be for me a complete kind of reverence and devotion anymore.
Yeah, no, I mean, you have a complicated
exactly. View, and I think that's it, and I think it's, you know, it's an interesting perspective to have, that you say we don't have as much for someone like Emily Dickinson, who is much more, I mean, seeing those two figures as kind of the founding people of American poetry, in a
right.
way, you know, as always pointed to as such, for better or for worse. And so,
well, it's weird how she, the more we allow her poems to be the way they really were written, mm-hmm. the more and more she seems avant-garde today.
Yeah, it's true.
But there's a settler, or a quote from a settler in Vanishing Line, mm-hmm. It reminded me of Whitman and regarding the danger of people becoming abstractions. So the settler says, after the Christians have multiplied and the natives have disappeared and melted away, a memorial of them may be preserved. And it made me think of how Whitman was very much for preserving native place names mm-hmm. across the country. He wanted them preserved unilaterally, I think, and uniformly. Like, he wanted the names of the places to be the native names, but he did seem less concerned about the ultimate actual end game for the native people themselves. And there's a poem he has at the end of his life about the redwoods disappearing that a mm-hmm. lot of people think is sort of a elegy for the red people, mm-hmm. also that the redwoods would disappear and the red people would disappear, and sort of as part of the inevitable die out for the American project.
Right.
So I want to read one more quote outside of your work by the critical theorist Homi Bhabha uh-huh. that says, the void that emerges through the act of writing is not an evocative abstraction lost in the mists of metaphor. The void is, quite literally, the empty space of erasure and extermination, of missing persons, destroyed things, hidden histories, lost records, expropriated lands, murdered minorities. The humanist must graphically evoke such emptiness and erasure without sublimating these absences, remaining all the while wary of every dream and nation. And I guess I wondered what your thoughts were on that quote, because mm-hmm. to me that's a really good description of Hey Marfa.
Yeah.
That it's graphically evoking emptiness as erasure,
uh-huh.
making visible the absences without sublimating them. But I didn't know if you even signed on to the sentiment of the quote in the first place. So I was curious what your thoughts were about maybe one of the projects being to make graphic what has been erased.
Yeah. No, I mean, I mean, I don't know what the exact context of the quote, of course, but from what you read there, I mean, no, I would agree with that too, because it's, I mean, in this book, I was also trying. You're talking about the graphic representation, but the poems unfold in a very visual way too. I mean, they're not just left justified or something, and so and that took. That was a big part of how I was writing this book, and so, and one of the reasons why, I mean, you're talking about hidden histories and things, and so, I mean, one is that I think of poetry on one level as a kind of digging, you know, below the surface of things to kind of deeper truths and trying to figure those things out. And also that this landscape, this desert landscape, it could be deceptively recursive in a way, repetitive. You're kind of driving out there or walking, and it's you could be complete, you're, I mean, I'm just, I was just completely overwhelmed by, you know, that contrast between the scrub and the sand, the hills in the distance, and then the sky, which is just enormous, and something's going on in the air there too. but then as you look more closely, you know, and people have asked me this before, and I don't know how else to say it, so I'm gonna have to repeat myself here. But as you look more closely, you really see how diverse even just the ecological life, you know, the plants and the animals live there and have found a home there, and it's the same with us as well. And so the book kind of unfolds in this kind of visual way, and on the one hand trying to echo some of that recursiveness through how the poems are laid out, and also things that kind of come back in different ways, themes and lines, and trying to really delve into some of those kind of places in history or how we view kind of nature in a way that have been, I don't know, overlooked in ways, or kind of deliberately repressed, you know, through our through the way we've kind of dominate the land here. So those are some of the things that
Well, as we move through, as we move toward Marfa and through Marfa and through the landscape, where we get, it's punctuated by high voltage substations, but it's also punctuated by caves, mm-hmm. some of which are the site of the deaths of Chinese laborers.
Yeah, exactly.
Thousands of which died blasting tunnels for the railroad. And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit more about that history. I mean, I'm imagining you and Marfa also, you're doing Chinese translation.
Uh-huh.
And also finding this Chinese history.
Yeah.
I don't know how memorialized or how buried that history is, and how visible is that history?
Yeah.
Or how much did you have to turn over things to find it?
Particularly with the Chinese railroad. Yeah. No, I mean, that's something that I learned about since college. Really. I mean, not much in high school, but it was really in college when that I read more and looked more at that history, you know. And it's also when you're dealing with these histories and these things, it becomes immediately complicated, and you're having to find the right balance, at least for me, in trying to write about it, you know. On the one hand, if you look at the history of kind of say Chinese American writing, poets, novelists in the U.S., there's a point where you see that they were almost expected to write about these things. You know, they're kind of like pigeonholed into these kinds of themes and stuff like that, which isn't a fair way to look at the work. But at the same time, I think coming out of that, one being the child of Chinese immigrants to the U.S., it's already kind of there for me to look at. But it's also part of the greater history too. I mean, that's the thing. And so I wanted to write about it. And for this particular history, it's also very hard to write about because there's no written records. I mean, that's in the poem. That's in the poem that I think you're talking about there. There's really no records. There's no letters or anything. And so that's always been. It's still to this day. You read about that history, and it's hard because people hope there's some archive maybe or some family library where there's some letters or something there. But you know, who knows? And so you're dealing with different kinds of things. You're dealing with like archaeology, you know, and your other disciplines, you know, come in to play very quickly when you're looking at that history. And so as far as the opening of the West is concerned and dealing with whatever this idea of the West is, we have that history of the railroads is just kind of completely necessary, I think, yeah. To think about, you know. And so, again, also, if you're looking at it from the perspective of how it's been treated in, say, Hollywood or in a lot of writing, it's always usually an afterthought or just kind of something, a setting, you know. And so I wanted to kind of like bring that in more deeply in a way if I could.
Well, I love how we don't get the Marfa of reputation until really deep in the book. So we go very far in Hey Marfa before we get the famous art of Marfa or even your art making in Marfa. But in the heart of the book, we do get a series of poems that are a conversation with this character you mentioned, the gunslinger Straw.
Right.
Who shares his thoughts on nonviolence, on memory, on the nature of Marfa, and more. So tell us about Straw, who he is, and how you see him functioning in the middle.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of half think it's better for readers if they look at it to figure that out themselves. But I could say like a few things about that. Yeah, no, for sure. that's why I'm here. But so those poems, I mean, it definitely comes directly out of the idea of the gunslinger, you know, it comes out of Ed Dorn's book, Gunslinger, his gunslinger poems. But then he of course was dealing with the cliche of the gunslinger in the West, in the history of the West.
Whose poems?
Edward Dorn.
Ed Dorn.
And so, I mean, what he's doing with it, that he calls him gunslinger throughout, and what he's doing is different in his long poem, but that figure, to make kind of to shorten it into Straw, STRA, it's one of the places in the book where there's really a multivalent title. It's because those poems are titled Straw and Figure in the book. It was one of the few really great epiphanies for me I had coming upon that, because it really opened up a way for me to write about some of the things in those poems that I was really struggling with in trying to deal with. And so by giving it a voice to this figure, which kind of alludes to many things, it could be, you know, strata or straw, like a straw man, even a little bit rack straw. But of course that's not him. But so some of these things that and other things that come in with that name really helped me figure out a way to write about that, and also to write about it in the voice, to make it a bit more fun, but also dealing with it in a kind of trying to engage with that, with the subject matter of those poems, you know, through this other voice again, like you're saying. But in this case, it was a made-up voice through, or imagined voice through straw. Yeah.
Can we hear one of them?
Oh yeah, sure.
Page 56.
Sure. Okay. Okay. You always choose the long ones. <Just kidding.
laughs> Are they all long?
No. I just meant like some of the substation. No, I'm fine. Most people choose a short one. So. Okay, straw. Marfa is no arid La Jolla. No Palm Springs decoy straw holds forth. No, not even a crude tract of La Mancha. They'll lance a windmill here and you'll be shot faster than you can say Alifanfaron. This place is perceived as a small, cosmopolitan oasis, celebrated for its current industry, art. Art as external creative force, more careful development. Mather's squalid desert. An art island that depends on poor locals and neighboring islands to keep costs down. And while not as shaka as Molokai, there's no hurry or rush. Rather, it's one contained speed trap. Push the gas and you'll find yourself at the pink courthouse, begging at the bench of Judge Cinderella, who will take cash for not changing your Prius into a pumpkin. Immigrants, illegals, cruelers and crafters, adobe mixers, day trippers, homesitters, hydroponic tomato pickers, ranchers, loners, passing celebrities and photo shooters if passing quickly, registered sex offenders if not offending, poets and failures, javelina, sausage makers, bond makers, readers, and home birthers, all make up the local fix. A place of few first words, desperado bookishness, no public playground, kids, scarce public schools and a downswing, low rent housing, harder to come by as out-of-towners buy and sell and buy, population waivers around 2,000, 70% Obama voters, most common surname Sanchez or Martinez, pick your plot, Latino or Anglo, bookstores to die for, ditto the radio station, cozy library, camp in a trailer, eat Mediterranean in a trailer, drool over Ramona's burritos, chain scarce, mind clears, leave your pretense at the Prada, a quiet simplicity settles in, to start anew or continue to lose your way and loose your imagination farther out to Presidio's giant battery reserve. Straw pauses, tosses back his mescalero, and I notice a scar running across the gular skin of his throat. But hey, Marfa, what do I know? I just got here. Tomorrow, hasta pronto. An airstrip would kill you.
It's great having you on the show today, Jeffrey.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
We're talking today to Jeffrey Yang, reading from his latest poetry collection, Hey Marfa, from Grey Wolf Press. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Ken Stringfellow and John Auer from the Posies on Thursday, January 17th at 8 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall in Portland. John Auer and Ken Stringfellow play Posies songs with a focus on the compositions, melodies, and harmonies. There'll be two guitars, two voices, and the occasional piano. Again, that's Ken Stringfellow and John Auer from the Posies on Thursday, January 17th at 8 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. This is an all-ages event. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 33rd Annual Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast on Monday, January 21st from 8:30 to 10:30 a.m. at the Red Line Hotel on the river at Jansen Beach. King County Councilor Larry Gossett will be the keynote speaker for the Skanner Foundation's 33rd Annual Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast. Gossett, who was first elected to the King County Council in 1993, served as chair of the entire council in 2007 and 2013. Again, that's the 33rd Annual Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast on Monday, January 21st from 8:30 to 10:30 a.m. at the Red Lion Hotel on the river at Jansen Beach, 909 North Hayden Island Drive in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Northwest Film Center's Real Music Festival from January 18th through February 16th at the Witzel Auditorium in Portland. Films showing this year include Mr. Soul, The Ballad of Shirley Collins, Solo, The Evolution of the One Man Band, Gospel According to Al Green, and many more. Again, that's the Northwest Film Center's Real Music Festival from January 18th through February 16th at the Witzel Auditorium, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Thursday, January 17th, 2019. In national news, it's day 26 of a partial government shutdown with no end in sight. 420,000 workers have been required to work without pay, and because of restrictions on the labor rights of federal employees, they have prevented them from striking or walking off the job. Trump could end the shutdown with a strike of his pen, but has instead chosen to hold the entire government hostage to his demand for $8 billion for a border wall, which even the conservative Cato Institute admits would be impractical, ineffective, and probably illegal. Because of the unprecedented length of the shutdown, food assistance for millions of low-income children, seniors, and people with disabilities is in jeopardy. This includes SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, also known as food stamps, which provides food to 40 million Americans, many of them children, disabled, and elderly people. Even children's school meals are at risk. Millions of low-income children's school meals could be affected via the National School Lunch Program, which provides about 30 million children with free or reduced-price meals. If the shutdown continues,